Blog Talk Radio.
We own this country. We own it. And it's not you owning it and not politicians owning it. Politicians are employees of ours. And they're just going to come around and beg for votes every few years, and it's the same old deal. But I just think that it's important that you realize that whether you're Democrat or whether you're a Republican or whether you're Libertarian or whatever, when somebody does not do the job, we've got to let them go.
When your entire culture is under attack, you need the country's number one voice in defense of our American way of life. You need an ally in the fight against tyranny and corruption. You need your weekly dose of Lisa Payne Nager. Missouri Grassroots Radio Network proudly adds our own beauty to America the Beautiful, your own culture vigilante, Ms. Lisa Payne Nager.
Good evening and Happy New Year. And this is Lisa Payne Nager. You're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio. This is your Culture Vigilante Hour. We're here every Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. And throughout the year, we here at Missouri Grassroots Radio and on Culture Vigilante have been very privileged to be able to bring you information crucial to advancing the grassroots movement in Missouri. Tonight, I want to play for you some of the highlights of the last year as a reminder of the need to remain vigilant in being informed and engaged about the issues that affect you and your families and your communities across the state and across the country. The Missouri Grassroots Coalition is dedicated in advancing the grassroots effort, and we hope that you have found the radio programming here beneficial in doing that, and we encourage you to join MGC in our efforts to engage citizens and hold accountable the government in order to restore constitutional principles to Missouri and our country. And as we get started tonight, I want to bring you several interviews that have helped to inform the folks across Missouri and across the country about just about how that movement is working. And tonight, not only has the grassroots movement and the new media brought you more truthful and enlightening coverage on the crucial issues that face our country, but it's also given birth to some very talented authors and writers. And throughout the year here on Culture Vigilante, we've been able to bring you some compelling interviews with people like Marinka Peshman, author of The Whistleblower and Following Orders. And tonight I want to replay an interview for you with Bob McCarty. Bob is an author of The 3 Days in August. And it's a true recounting of how the U.S. government sold out a Marine for political diplomacy. And by the way, I also want to let you know, we're anxiously awaiting Bob's second book with the working title of The Clapper Memo. So here's that interview with Bob McCarty. Our next guest is blogger and author Bob McCarty, bobmccarty.com. And he's written a new book, 3 Days in August. And he's here to tell us a little bit about that. But Bob, you've been doing more than just writing books these days. You've got another thing going on too. And I was on your website last night, and it's totally different than what I've been used to. So how are you doing tonight, Bob?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on, Lisa.
Well, yeah, we appreciate it.
After nearly six years online, I finally redesigned the website, and I am from this point forward no longer a blogger. I have shed the pajamas. I'm wearing shoes most of the day. And I'm no longer calling myself a blogger. It's retired.
The blogging world is in mourning because you did a lot of great work on bobmccarty.com.
Well, I'm still going to put work on bobmccarty.com, and I appreciate those kind words. But most of the work I've been doing in the past couple of years has been investigative work, very little of what most people consider blogging. I've been working on the book you mentioned, 3 Days in August, and I've got a new one, which is just a few months from completion, called The Clapper Memo. And no, it has nothing to do with turning lights on or off.
We'll get to that in a minute, but I was looking at the... Don't make me laugh. I was looking at the trailers that you had for The Clapper Memo. I mean, well, I know about the 3 Days in August book, and it's appalling. Those of you who out there who've read 3 Days in August, to understand the corruption and the way that we can throw our military folks under the bus is appalling, but I think when you read the Clapper Memo, it's going to be even more engaging and more telling. So, but let's back up. Let's talk about 3 Days in August, Bob. Great book. You and I have talked back and forth about it. I don't, you know, with this kind of thing going on with our military
and how this poor guy got thrown under the bus to save the diplomatic envoys of across the country. You know, I don't know why people go into the military. This poor guy has just been through it.
Yeah, you know, and believe me, this book was not intended to besmirch anyone in the military. It's really just trying to get one member of the military who was basically given a raw deal. It's just intended to spread the word and hopefully get people riled up enough that we can get him a new trial, or even better yet, have all of his charges dropped and have his conviction overturned. But I should probably back up and tell your listeners about the book. Basically, in March of 2010, I became aware of the story of Army Green Beret Sergeant Kelly Stewart. He had been accused by a 28-year-old German woman of rape and kidnapping while he was on assignment. He had just been assigned to a NATO school in Germany where he was a sniper and survival skills instructor, and he was living in a hotel until he got his permanent quarters. He went out to a nightclub in Stuttgart nearby that was popular with Americans. He met this young lady on the dance floor. Things progressed until, a couple hours after midnight, they both agreed they were going back to his hotel. Both of them knew it was going to be a one-night stand, you know. As much as anybody will think poorly of him for that decision, those kinds of things happen, especially when soldiers are far from home, okay? So get past that. It's probably the worst move, the worst decision he ever made in his life. But they had their one-night stand. He said it was pretty much uneventful as those go, you know. And about a little over 2 months later, he had not seen her again, but she had gone to the police in the local community there and reported that he had raped and kidnapped her in the hotel room that night. He didn't find out anything about the allegations until early in 2009, and he found out by going to the personnel office at the Army post where he was located and found out his records were flagged. A couple months later, he found out why they were flagged, and in May of 2009, he was undergoing an Article 32 investigation, or preliminary hearing phase, where the Army had to decide whether the charges the lady was making against him were worthy of court-martial. But lo and behold, they found him needing to stand trial for these charges. So there was no evidence, no physical evidence, no eyewitnesses, nothing to support. It was just a he said versus she said situation.
And then the rest of your book chronicles the details and the allegations and lack thereof of support of those allegations. Can you kind of give us a rundown? How's Kelly doing?
Well, he's doing well. He was found guilty during 3 days in August of 2009. He was sentenced to 8 years at Leavenworth. Later, there was a post-trial hearing. He was his sentence was reduced from 8 years down to 3 years, and 7 months after that reduction in sentence, he was actually released from Leavenworth early, and he's out on parole right now. He's living in Virginia.
Not with
his family. As I said, he made a bad decision to have the one night stand with a woman who was not his wife, but he is not the first person to do that wearing the uniform. They never charged him for adultery. He is living in Virginia. He cannot live in Colorado where his wife and children are located because Colorado requires anyone who's been convicted of a sexual offense, and he is now branded a sex offender for the rest of his life unless the charge gets overturned or reversed. And so he's living in Virginia while his family is residing in Colorado. Colorado makes a person sign a statement admitting their guilt before they can live in the state, and he refuses to admit guilt for the crimes which he did not commit. Now, the book itself, it's based on extensive interviews I've done with Kelly and other people. It's based on the actual record of trial. I'm the only media person, reporter, investigator in the world that Kelly Stewart has talked to. I was just fortuitous in gaining that opportunity. But, you know, it's if anybody reads the book and reads, you know, the actual record of trial, which I go through almost line by line, you can't help but find the guy innocent. And if you still think he's guilty after reading it, he says, so be it. At least you read it. But he hasn't run into anybody yet who's read the entire record of trial or read my book who doesn't just feel like their blood's boiling afterwards. So this guy, the country spent nearly $1 million training him for more than 15 years. His record was, he was the cream of the crop. He was on his way to the top. You know, he's the son of a 30-year special operations guy. He was heading for stars, okay? But thanks to this lady, who, by the way, in the German system, gets compensated monthly as a victim of a sex-related offense, and who, by the way, was a mental patient for 4 months prior to this, and who, by the way, during the trial said that she was not able to be around men or be with men anymore since the night she was with Stewart. Her friends came forward later and said she had actually slept with two and possibly three men after she had been with Stewart, and two of them took place before the trial, at which she said she couldn't be with men. So
yeah, and all of this, they threw this very valuable, trained military man under the bus for diplomatic, international diplomacy.
Pretty much, and you know that's how they treated this guy. He had spent most of the previous 4 years doing what he calls secret squirrel stuff, undercover, blending in with the population in Iraq for 4 years. And in the book, I have a couple. One chapter in particular is based on an interview I did with one of his special forces brothers about how Kelly, in John Wayne fashion, one guy he's with on a little gun truck. One guy gets shot in the chest. Another buddy is down there tending to him, you know, as a medic. And Kelly's driving the vehicle and firing the machine gun on top, going through a Sadr City, which is kind of like the Dodge City of the Surge era in Iraq. And he's doing this, you know, all by himself. This is the kind of guy, you know, he just, he would give his life for his buddies. He did it for 4 years. He gets finally gets reassigned to schoolhouse duty in Germany, which they all have to do once in a while. And he made a mistake, but the mistake shouldn't have cost him his career, more or less his life and his family, which it has so far.
This book is loaded with documentation, loaded with information. The facts will just shock you. So, Bob, where can you get the book?
You can get it on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. You can walk into virtually any bookstore in America and ask for it by name, but very few of them are stocking it. To learn more about it, you go to 3daysinaugust.com or bobmccarty.com. But, you know, it's out there. I did a book signing at Barnes & Noble recently in the St. Louis area, and we sold more books than any other author had so far this year.
Excellent.
So it's moving. Now, should I say that I was the only author at this Barnes & Noble this year or not?
Yeah, let's go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, I just love saying that. I've sold more at this store than any other author, though I'm the only author at the bookstore this year. But anyway.
When will the Clapper memo be out?
The Clapper memo, I hope to get out by October 1st. Now, the skinny on the Clapper memo is I've connected the dots, no kidding, between the deaths of dozens of Americans at the hands of the people we call our allies in Afghanistan. These are the green-on-blue killings. I've connected the dots between those killings, why they're happening at such a fast pace. We've had more than, I think it's up to around 60 Americans killed by friendly, you know, Afghans, supposedly, since 2007, okay? And I've connected those killings with a memo signed by the guy who now serves as our Director of National Intelligence, James R. Clapper, Jr. Now, James R. Clapper, Jr., I couldn't resist the name Clapper, so the book is called The Clapper Memo.
Okay, and you can read more about that at bobmccarty.com, too. Bob, we'll have you back to talk more about the Clapper Memo because I want to get into it in greater detail, but we're running a little long. Thanks for being with us tonight. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Lisa. Take care.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
One of the things we've tried to do here on Culture Vigilante is to spotlight patriot groups, organizations, and initiatives that have formed to be an influence of change in Missouri and across the country. And one such group in Missouri is the Missouri Precinct Project. The ladies of MOPS have worked really hard throughout the year to identify conservative voters precinct by precinct in hopes of swaying the past election in November and future elections to come. So please enjoy this interview.
One of the goals of the Missouri Precinct Project, besides voter registration, besides getting people to the polls, is to get people involved locally. Pay attention to what their city halls and their township meetings are doing, and run for those positions to start turning the party around from the ground up. In St. Louis County, we have 56 committee men and committee women positions, and in addition to the incumbents, we have 35 new people that filed for those positions. We have the same issue, the same thing going on in St. Charles County, lots of new people filing for those positions, and across the whole state, people have filed for committee men and women positions in record numbers. And I think in one or two elections, we can turn around the party, make it more responsive, do the things that need to be done instead of just telling us what to do, we'll tell them what to do.
Absolutely. Giving the government back to the people, that's fantastic. So, Judy, tell me a little bit. Missouri Precinct Project works on issues of voter fraud, getting people to the poll, finding poll workers and things like that. Tell me a little bit about that.
Okay, well, our mission statement is, to quote it, is to restore constitutional principles and conservative values by engaging conservatives in grassroots politics, which kind of dovetails with what you were talking about earlier with Laura. We have basically a four-pronged strategy. Our main focus, with us being named the Missouri Precinct Project, of course, is to promote the idea to people to – we believe in working from the bottom up. So we want people to take control of their life and their government and the most local level, which would be your central committees within each county. And in those central committee positions, there are approximately 30 to 40% of those positions that go unfilled in the state and, in fact, in the nation. So this is a great opportunity, as you mentioned, for our new people, our constitutional conservatives, to fill these positions and to, you know, bring with them the principles and the values that we find to be important and restore integrity to politics as a result. So that's one of our main focuses, and we've had a lot of excellent feedback statewide from various folks like Frieda mentioned that are getting involved in the process where they never even had given it a thought before. We try to give them the tools, the education, and the knowledge of how to go about doing that. Many states have precinct groups like we are, and we felt that Missouri needed to have that same advantage, so that's what caused us to form the organization. Again, we also work with Get Out the Conservative Vote. We utilize programs like Champion the Vote to do that. We'll be working, the third prong of our strategy is to train and encourage poll workers kind of beyond what they get from the election board to watch out for anomalies that might happen at the polling places and
to eliminate voter fraud.
Voter fraud, yes, exactly. And then the fourth prong would be to build and maintain a conservative database of conservatives so we can have a more united voice as we, you know, encounter issues on the state and national level that we can all come together on and have more impact. So that's kind of how, and we accomplish this by kind of like most grassroots groups, we try to motivate, educate, and activate people to get involved in their communities at the local level with the thought that, you know, we believe more in the trickle-up theory than the trickle-down theory. We believe if we can, you know, kind of statue duck with constitutional conservatives from the bottom up, that it will eventually, you know, move
and,
through the
and
layers of government.
Absolutely. So at the grassroots level, you ladies have organized this wonderful event on July 14th, winning in November. Tell me very quickly a little bit about that event.
I can go ahead and tell you about that. It's going to be at the Pillar Foundation. It's on Saturday, July 14th. It will be an all-day seminar. The cost is $25 per attendee, and it includes box lunch, beverage, and training materials. We will have a more, we're not quite sure the order, but the two seminars will involve two separate issues. One would be helping to prevent voter fraud by becoming a poll worker, which will feature True the Vote that we're also cooperating with. And then the other session would have to do with getting out the conservative vote. And we just learned today that our guest speaker will be Chris Littleton from American Majority, who's the executive director in Ohio for American Majority. So we're really looking forward to that. A Pillar Foundation is located at 15820 Clayton Road in Ellisville, Missouri, 63011. You can get information about the event from going to our website, and we will have information there for that. You can
name your website, Judy. What's your website?
It would be missouriprecinct.org, and it's just the abbreviation, moprecinctproject.org. And then we'll have a link to they will be linked over to American Majority, where they will have a sign up page for the event. We'll also have an event notice on Facebook and on FreedomWorks that they can find out the details of the event and sign up also.
Okay, that's great, ladies. We'll also have this information up at Missouri Grassroots Coalition on the website there, so that you can get that information. And we'd love to have you ladies on again, maybe again next week, talk a little bit more in depth about this wonderful seminar that you're putting on July 14th. Ladies, thank you so much for being with us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us, Lisa.
Thank you.
You guys have a good evening. Good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
I consider one of the most positive accomplishments of the last year to be the education and illumination of the broader patriot community on the issues of the Middle East and the facts of the Muslim culture. And since the disaster of 9/11, we've been brainwashed and politically corrected to deny the realities of what the Muslim invasion really means to our American way of life. This year, I've had the pleasure of becoming friends with Usama Dakdok and learning from him and his lovely wife, Vicky, about the real threats being perpetrated on Americans by this very dangerous and destructive heritage. So please listen to this interview and learn as much as you can about this culture. Your government and the media have not been telling you the full story.
Just when you thought it was all over, when you thought it was time to hang it all up, Lisa is back.
That's right. She's back. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you're listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio. This is your Culture Vigilante Hour. There couldn't be a better lead-in for our next guest, Usama Dakdok, who's here to talk to us tonight about the movie that caused all the problems, the video movie, the YouTube movie that blew up the Middle East, that sparked the murder of our embassy ambassadors and our Marines over there. It's the root of all evil. It's about the movie, and the president said so, and it took him 2 weeks to figure out that it wasn't the movie. So everything's under control. Osama, my friend, welcome back.
Hello, my dear sister. How are you? You
I'm
make
good.
Me laugh. That is a movie which caused all the trouble in the Middle East. I think the people in the Middle East have seen much better argument, a much better material, which we have broadcast live on the TV all over the Middle East in Arabic and in English for the last 7 years. And nothing happened. I was speaking to Sean Hannity on his show a few weeks ago, and I have the privilege to talk with him for 9 minutes, believe it or not. And I told Sean 35 years ago, before there was even any movie or any talk on the internet or the whatever the technology we have today, Muslims were shouting in the mosque across the street from my church, "Death to America and death to Israel," before there was any movie. The problem is, my dear sister, that we have in America liberals who are willing to lie to make an excuse for whatever Muslims do, and we have American people in general who are unaware, or the right word which I always love to use is ignorant of Islam, and they will try to find any excuse. Even Bob, up to this evening, 5 o'clock, the 5 show on Fox News, Bob is saying, yeah, the movie has something to do. Maybe he's asking, what do you think causes the people to be mad and angry? I said, no, it's not the movie. It is the word of Allah in the Quran. It is the command of Muhammad in the Hadith. That's why Muslim has been always, since he exists 1400 years ago until today, hate Muslim, hate Christian, hate Jews, hate anyone and everyone who does not believe in Islam. Have nothing to do with Bush, have nothing to do with America. Before there was America, Muslim hated Christian and Jew. Even
right.
when Muhammad lived in his small town in Saudi Arabia.
So you'd pretty much have to be living under a rock to have believed that it was the movie that caused the death of our ambassador.
Not just a rock. You must might as well be in a coma. Because if you live under the rock, you figure out that it have nothing to do with the movie. I mean, I don't think living has to do anything with believing this lie. And you know what? You know what's amazing, Lisa, about all the whole situation here? It's until today, Muslims benefit from this movie. No kidding. Do you know that Muslims benefit from the first September 11, 11 years ago? They benefit from it in America.
So how does that work? How does it? What do you mean benefit by that? Does it just it kind of emboldens them?
Listen,
it charges them up?
I can give you numbers. You'll be shocked. You know that since September 11, the first September 11, which is 11 years ago until today, Islam is spreading in America to be the loving, peaceful religion because Bush told the American people we're not in war with Islam. Islam is a loving, peaceful religion. I mean, when you have September 11 in America and 3,000 plus Americans were killed in a few minutes, and then you get your politician with the stupidity of political correctness speaking about that Islam is a loving, peaceful religion. I can let you hear the Vice President, Cheney, Bush, Condoleezza Rice, everybody in Bush and administration spoke highly of Islam and of Muslim, and they said, just we're going to hunt and we're going to go on war against the radical Muslim. See, inventing the word radical Muslim and the other word, moderate Muslim, is a benefit for the Muslim. And how did the world start learning about radical Muslim and moderate Muslim? It started after September 11, as Bush, the first president, lied to the American people. Now we got Obama continue to lie. So what, if these people in Libya did this something bad there, you know, kill four Americans, and the burning of the flag all over the world, it must be because we insulted Muhammad. We insulted Islam, therefore we're going to give them millions of dollars. I mean, $450 million to Egypt, and all of these things are going to be sent to them. We're about sending four stealth warships, which cost us $2 billion, our tax money, to Egypt. Why are we doing that? Because they have benefited from a lie spread by Obama. The Muhammad movie had nothing to do with what's happening around the world. Add to that, Lisa, add to that. If you go online to our website, thestraightway.org, or go to YouTube and just type Revealing the Truth Behind the Muhammad Movie. Revealing the Truth Behind the Muhammad Movie. And it's also on Facebook. It's all over. We have many people carry it, which sadly, in my own YouTube, I only have 2,000 people watch it. But if you go to other sites, they already have a million people watch it because nobody knows who I am anyway. But if you go and watch my video, you'll learn that nothing in this movie is not true. I mean, when we say Muhammad have multiple wives, when we say Christians are persecuted, when we say Christians are forced to confess to crimes they did not commit, when we say Muhammad was a pedophile, when we say Muhammad was a womanizer, when we say Muhammad was an adulterer, when we say Muhammad was a thief, when we say Muhammad is a killer, when we say Islam is a religion have nothing to do with tolerance, when we all of these 20 segments we have in this 14-plus minute trailer. By the way, this trailer is a joke because it's a poor quality of camera, sound, light, acting. It's very poor. But the message in every second in this movie is true. And how do I know it's true? I opened the Quran, my dear sister. I opened the Hadith. I opened the interpretation of Muslim scholars to the verses of the Quran. And that's what we did in our video. It's 2-hour video. It's fun to listen to it. And I promise you, you'll come out and say, wait a minute, where is the insult here? See, here's another benefit, Lisa, because we're telling the world we're insulting Muhammad. No, we told the truth in a simple words about Muhammad, the wicked, barbaric, child molester, sex offender, the prophet, pretender, womanizer, thief, killer, name it, Muhammad, the prophet of Islam. So
okay.
I
want to make sure that I am going to post it. Usama has put together a documentary dissecting dissecting this video that has been the firestorm of controversy around the world and that supposedly set off the firestorm of all of the issues going on, the blow-up in the Middle East. he's taken this and he's dissected it and he's put together the information about what's true and what's not. And you've also written a book too, Usama. You've got your latest book out is a translation of the Quran. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. The Jewish Quran is the first true accurate English translation. And by the way, our new book coming up within a few weeks from now here, The Revelation of Error, which we will go in depth into the Quran to show to our dear Muslim friends and to show the Americans this Quran is nothing but a dumb counterfeit to the Bible. Literally, it's nothing but a dumb counterfeit to the Bible. The problem with you, Sister Lisa, and all these wonderful listeners who listen to us, the problem is we do not know hardly anything about Muhammad. We do not know anything about Islam. Or somebody say, wait a minute, how dare you tell me that Muhammad is a pedophile? That is insulting to the Prophet of Islam. That is wonderful. You tell me, 51 years old man, married to a 6 years old child. As a matter of fact, if you time it in our American timing here, the 12 months here, 365 days, she was actually 5.5 years old. A 6 years old child to a 51 years old husband. What do you call this? Marriage made in heaven? Or you call him a sex offender, a prophet, a pretender? Of course. So because American people don't know, so wait a minute, another piece of the video. Muhammad commit adultery. How dare you are to tell me Muhammad commit adultery? He insulted Islam. He insulted the prophet of Islam. I say, wait a minute. Why not we open the Quran, chapter 66 and verse 1, and read what Allah said. Oh, you prophet, why do you forbid what Allah has made lawful to you, seeking to please your wives? Okay, let's read the interpretation of Muslim scholar. What did Muhammad forbid himself? Oh, he will tell you, Muhammad Mary al-Qatiyya. Muhammad had sex with Mary, the Coptic woman, at his wife Hafsa, in her bed, on her night, and she saw them together. He said, please don't tell Aisha. Please don't tell Aisha. Lower your voice, as we see it in the movie. And then he said, I swear by Allah, I will never have sex with this young lady again. I swear by Allah. And then Muhammad, later, he want to have sex with her. He want to marry her. So Allah release him. Allah relieve him from his oath. And he said, why do you forbid what I made lawful to you, seeking to please your wife? Therefore, Muhammad was able to have sex with her again. Where do we see Muhammad in the Quran? A womanizer. It's very simple. You go to Quran chapter 63 and verse 50, where Allah gave him a list of every female living and dead. Literally, Muhammad had sex with his dead aunt after she died. Can you imagine that? Muhammad in the Quran, chapter 63, verse 50. By the way, they were trying to pass a law in Egypt last year about allowing men, Muslim men, in Egypt. In the year 2011, for heaven's sake. Just last year. They are they were trying to pass a law for Muslim men to be able to have sex. To have sex with their dead wife up to 6 hours after she died. Can you imagine a man have a wife, she died, 6 hours later will take her clothes off and have sex with her again? I mean, how wicked this be. And these are the legislators. These are the new people whom Obama bragging about democracy in Egypt. Now we have new Congress in Egypt who's going to pass law. What is the law they're going to pass? Bring the age of marriage to 6 years old, because Muhammad had sex with a 6 year married 6 years old. Therefore, now Egyptian can marry younger children, because otherwise you're insulting Muhammad. Think about it, Lisa. If I tell you the marriage age in Egypt right now is 16 for the girl. Wait a minute. Are you trying to tell me Muhammad was a child molester? He married 6 and had sex with her when she was 9. And by the way, if you go to the Quran, chapter 65, verse 4, you will see that Allah gave Muslims the right to marry children and have sex with them before the first period, I mean, when they're still children who have not yet begun menstruation. This is right. This is how sick Islam is. But the problem is, Americans do not know the Quran.
And that's absolutely it. That's what all of this boils down to, Usama. And you travel the country trying to educate the American culture about what the Islamic culture really is,
let me put this in a different word. I don't want to say culture. I say cult. Islam is not a cult. Yes, America here, we have culture in America, and we have faith in America, and we have different beliefs. But Islam is not just culture. It is a cult. And as I was sharing with you, when we see that Allah in the Quran, tell him Muhammad, chapter 33, verse 50, O you prophet, if a believing woman offer herself to you, can you imagine that? A believing woman offer herself to Muhammad. sexually. If the prophet desired to have sex with her, this is a privilege for you alone, that there will not be shame on your part. So everything you can imagine in this movie, Muslim, if you know, I did this on our radio broadcast in Block Talk Radio, and we did it for 4 weeks, 5 weeks, and I begged one Muslim to come to our show and tell me which part of the movie he think it is insulting to Muhammad. And I will do this anytime. It's going to be on VCY. It starts next week. You can listen to us on VCYAmerican.org, VCYAmerican.org, every day at 12:30 for half hour, and it's going to be 16 programs. We record 16 programs. And I dare any Muslim to show me any section in the entire 14-minute trailer to show me, here is insult to Muhammad. And I will take him to his book, the Quran, his book, the Hadith, the interpretation of Muslim scholar and Muslim scholar books, and I will show him that nothing in this movie is a lie. And the sad thing, Lisa, is I wish these people, before they did this movie or this trailer, I wish they talked to me, because I know how Muslim will react to the movie. And I would say, before you mention anything, say, let's look at the Quran, chapter so-and-so, and verse so-and-so. Let's read the interpretation of the great Muslim scholar Al-Qurtubi or Ibn Kathir or whatever. Or let's read this in the book of this. And then go ahead, do the play, or do the drama and put in the bottom, Quran chapter 5, verse 52. That's it. Why? Because Muslims cannot argue with you. As a matter of fact, they will pretend that this movie is not there. Because if you talk about it, they will insult themselves. We did not insult Muhammad, Lisa. Muhammad insulted himself of his teaching and of his action, of his way of life. This is a very insulting man. I'm sorry that say that.
Wow. Okay. Usama has put together a fantastic, it's almost 2 hours, it's a two-hour YouTube video. I'm going to post it up at Missouri Grassroots Coalition.org, and we'll put it on the Facebook page as well, so that you have a chance to take a look at that video. I'm sure it's up at Straightway Ministries, right?
Yes, ma'am. That's straightway.org. It's available on our website as well. We have it there on the front page and our home page. That's straightway.org. You can just go on YouTube and search for Revealing the Truth Behind the Muhammad Movie. And please, share it with your friends. I want everybody to know, because that's another opportunity for the American people to know the truth about Muhammad. And I guarantee you, this film will die, and we will not benefit from it, but Muslims will benefit from it. Let me give you another benefit, Lisa. You know how Muslims are going to benefit from this as well here in America? They will convince our legislators to pass a law in America. Anyone and everyone who speak against Muhammad, who insult Islam, must be arrested and put in jail. I will be in prison someday for talking about this movie in some church or in some radio program like we have right now. So American Muslim will benefit from this movie, but we Christian, when we American, will not. For they will silence anyone who speaks against Islam under this so-called insulting Muhammad. I just have a friend of mine in Pakistan 3 days ago. He got arrested. And the excuse they got against him for being arrested is a pastor in Pakistan, because they said he insulted Muhammad. You know, for heaven's sake, if you're in Egypt or in any Muslim country and somebody asks you, do you believe in Prophet Muhammad? You say no. Okay, that's insult to Muhammad. Literally.
Right. In order for Sharia to flourish, you have to stop the freedom of speech.
Absolutely.
If we have freedom of speech
in America, Muslims will never take over this country. They will take over this country when they silence us. They will take over this country when Obama takes the guns out of us. We will take over this country when we become just like Greece or some weak financially, economically. And that's what Obama will do in this country if he has 4 more years. We pray.
Absolutely.
We're going to have to pray the next few days here.
All right. Usama, thank you so much for being with us. We're going to put that video up, as I said, at Missouri Grassroots Coalition.
Thank you, Lee. Appreciate you.
Go to Straightway Ministries, look for the video, look for Usama's translation of the Quran, and there's, I'm sure, if you've never had the opportunity to see Usama speak in public, this video is a great chance for you to get a chance to see him speak, and if he's in your area, jump on that opportunity to see Usama speak. He was in the St. Charles County area over September 11th, and he mesmerized people here. They just love him, and we can't wait for him to come back. Thank you, Usama, for being with us.
Thank you, sister. God bless you, and God bless your program. Bye-bye.
We'll talk to you soon.
Sure, bye-bye.
In 2012, the Obama administration attempted to pass UN treaties that would drastically change the Constitution and America's culture of parental rights and educational freedoms. And in the interest of those issues, we followed very closely the efforts of parentalrights.org to help you understand the seriousness of these issues. And tonight, I want to replay an interview with parentalrights.org's William Estrada. And here he clearly outlines the dangers of these UN treaties. And while last year's efforts to pass these treaties failed, it's very important for you all to know that there is an intention of resurrecting these initiatives to pass them in 2013. So let's listen to William Estrada of parentalrights.org.
If you've been listening to Culture Vigilante for any period of time, you know that we have really flagged the UN issues and the Agenda 21 issues, and we regularly have Ray Cuneo on with us to explain the details of Agenda 21 piece by piece. He's done a great job of doing that for us, and he will be on with us later on this evening. We've also, and if you know anything about my background or if you remember anything, you know, I'm a homeschooling mom, big on parental rights, big on education issues, and we've been following the issues with parentalrights.org and the UN treaties that they're trying to pass through to undermine your personal liberties and freedoms. And tonight we have with us Mr. William Estrada. He's the Director of Federal Relations for parentalrights.org. And we've had an election. It didn't quite go the way we had hoped. We know that the Obama administration is neck deep in the UN and the One World Order issues, and everything in the agenda reflects that advancement of the UN and their agendas. And Mr. Estrada is here with us tonight to explain a little bit to us about the dangers of the upcoming lame duck session, and next week, in fact, on the treaties of the UNCRPD. Thanks for being with us tonight, Mr. Estrada. We're happy to have you.
Lisa, great to be on with you. Thank you.
Bye.
So it seems that parentalrights.org, we've had some folks from parentalrights.org on before to talk to us a little bit about these treaties. Do you want to give us just a little bit of background or a little refresher on the UNCRPD and the UNCRC and kind of tell us where we stand with these things and why they're a danger to us real quickly?
Absolutely. Well, as you mentioned, Lisa, there are two dangerous United Nations treaties out there. The first one is called the Convention on the Rights of the Child. It's actually been around since 1989. The Senate has never ratified it, which is a good thing. The other treaty, however, that is a much more recent treaty, is called the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. This treaty was just signed by the Obama administration earlier this year. It had a Senate hearing, and it's on the fast track for ratification in the U.S. Senate. Now, our listeners are probably wondering, well, rights of persons with disabilities, rights of the child, these sound like good treaties. And on the face of them, who can argue with making sure that children have rights? The problem, however, is severalfold. The first one is, in our Constitution, our founders said in Article 6, it's called the Supremacy Clause, that a treaty, if ratified by two-thirds of the Senate, or 67 senators, it becomes the supreme law of the land. It trumps state law, trumps state courts. It's the supreme law of the land, right up there with acts of Congress and the U.S. Constitution. So looking at that, with these treaties suddenly become supreme law, we have to look at what do these treaties say. And unfortunately, despite their nice-sounding names, these are attempts by the United Nations to, number one, usurp United States sovereignty, and number two, to usurp parental rights. Both treaties, Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities and the Convention on the Rights of the Child, have language which says, in all matters concerning children, the disabilities one says children with disabilities, and then the treaty goes on to say, the best interests of the child standard shall be the standard used in any matter concerning children. What does this mean? Well, currently in our country, the best interests of the child standard, some of our listeners may have heard this if they went through a divorce or knew someone who went through a divorce, when the parents can't decide what's best for little Johnny. So the court gets involved and says, well, here's what's in the best interest of the child. This standard is also used when parental rights have been terminated due to maybe gross parental abuse or neglect. If these treaties were to be ratified, Lisa, however, this standard used in divorces and termination of parental rights would be used any time a social worker or a court official or any government person felt that a parent, they didn't like what the parent is deciding for their child. It would turn parental rights on their head.
I've been through this, and I know that these standards are the best interest of the child standards is very vague, and it gives the government, the system, the establishment, a lot of leeway in determining from case to case where they want to take things. They have a lot of leeway in twisting things to go in their direction.
And that's something which, if someone has gone through a divorce, they have seen firsthand that all of a sudden the court gets involved. And the scary thing is we say, oh, well, you know, this will never happen here. Our country,
no.
We have laws and systems to protect it. Unfortunately, there are people who really want to see these treaties become ratified, become the supreme law of the land, and then use these treaties to strip away parental rights. Parentalrights.org, you can visit us at www.parentalrights.org to find out more about the treaty, and also our sister organization, Homeschool Legal Defense Association, of which I'm an attorney for that organization. We are fighting right now to make sure that the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities is not ratified, rushed through the U.S. Senate in the dead of night during the lame duck session. We're fighting an uphill battle, and Lisa, I'm glad that you brought this to the attention of our listeners. Tomorrow's Thanksgiving, we're gathering with family and friends, but let's also make sure that we contact our U.S. senators, that we get the word out about the dangers of the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, and longer term, the Convention on the Rights of the Child.
Can we give just a couple of examples of what, just a few of these details on in these treaties, what that will mean to folks? What do those kinds of things look like to just the average folks if these things are ratified? What are the
Absolutely. On our webpage, actually, one of the web pages, you can visit the document that I'm about to just mention a few highlights from. It's called hslda.org/CRPD, Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. And my boss, the founder of HSLDA and parentalrights.org, he made a document called 10 Reasons to Oppose the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Some of the key points, one of them in Article 4 of this CRPD treaty, it says that every person, organization, or private enterprise must eliminate discrimination on the basis of disability. Unlike the Americans with Disabilities Act, which provides great protections for people with disabilities, this language would make it so that the United Nations could then come into any home, any business, and say, you are not meeting the standards of what we think people with disabilities should have. Both of these treaties, the Disabilities Treaty and the Convention on the Rights of Persons, Convention on the Rights of the Child, will set up an unelected, unaccountable UN committee, which will then implement this treaty in our country and in other countries that have ratified these treaties. And it's very instructive, Lisa, to look and see, well, what are these committees, what type of guidance are they giving to countries that have ratified them? In Ireland, which recently ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the committee said Ireland is failing to meet this treaty because they allow parents to pull their children out of sex ed in the public schools.
Mm-hmm.
So this committee is sitting there, and it will be implementing these treaties, the CRPD or the Convention on the Rights of the Child, if we ratify it. They're sitting there and telling these countries, you need to change your laws to make it so that parents cannot pull their kids out of sex ed. The Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities goes on to, again, have that best interest of the child standard. It then also, one of the funny things with the Disabilities Treaty, it doesn't define what is a disability. So a disability could become anything that someone thinks it is, which I think not only causes great harm from a legal perspective, but also weakens protections of people with disabilities.
Absolutely. And if you don't think that they're going to make something up on a case-by-case basis to fit their agenda, you are sadly mistaken. They do it all the time already. So, you know, it's like Mr. Estrada says, I mean, you know, they can come in and decide that they don't like a certain situation in your home for whatever reason. And we're going to have Dr. Brian Ray on a little bit later to talk a little bit more about this in more detail about what these kinds of things look like. They absolutely can. These people are masters at twisting a situation to fit their agenda. They absolutely can come in and determine, and if the system is set up to get to an end result, I mean, you will not be the winner in this situation. And it's all very broad, and it's all very vague, and, you know, always up for interpretation. So you're not going to be the one who wins when you're put into this issue.
You know, Lisa, when we're looking at these treaties, there are two key questions that come up. And the first one is something which is near and dear to our heart at Homeschool Legal Defense Association and at parentalrights.org. It's very simply this: who do we trust to better care for, to love, to protect, and to raise children? Mm-hmm. Is it their parents, the ones who have this God-given right and responsibility from birth to raise their children, to sacrifice them? So is it parents, or is it a government bureaucrat or a United Nations bureaucrat sitting in an office in Geneva, Switzerland? And I'm going to go with parents on this. Even if there's a well-meaning government official, they will never know that child's name, that person, that personality, like a parent will. And so why do we want to surrender the rights of children and the rights of children and people with disabilities to a government bureaucrat instead of a parent? That's the first key question.
Right.
The second key question is, why are we in the United States preparing, why are our U.S. senators preparing to surrender sovereignty to an unelected, unaccountable United Nations? Shouldn't Americans make the law for Americans? We elect our leaders in Congress, and our country is frankly a model of protecting children's rights and protecting people with disabilities. We don't need to then surrender this, that we've elected people, they've passed the Americans with Disabilities Act and laws to protect children and laws to protect people with disabilities. We don't need to surrender this to the United Nations. And those are the two key questions that I say, keep going back to it. Why are we wanting to surrender parental rights to government officials? And why do we want to surrender American sovereignty to the United Nations?
I mean, that's exactly the question. I mean, we are seeing in great detail, because we've been following the Agenda 21 issues here at Missouri Grassroots Radio, there really is a huge push from our legislature to follow this One World Order issue coming in from the United Nations. Why are our legislators so quick to sign on to this? Why are they even entertaining this with such interest? It's kind of boggles the mind.
It's sad, actually. And frankly, there's a book, maybe your listeners are well aware of it. It's called It Takes a Village to Raise a Child.
Hillary.
It was written by Hillary Clinton in the early 90s. And in that book, she's not saying, oh, grandparents and family and friends are important. She has a parent needs help to come and support that parent in raising a child. No, her position in that book is we can't trust parents to raise kids. It takes government officials and the village and all of these people to come in and raise kids. And that's not what our country was founded on. And that's not how we're going to see the next generation prepared to lead our country and to make decisions and to raise a family for themselves.
Right. I mean, it just, all of this contributes to the breakdown of the family structure. And if you break down the family structure, you break down the very fabric of America. And that's the last thing that we need in this country. Okay, parentalrights.org has done a great job of organizing. They have a number of things that we can do as citizens in America and hopefully citizens in Missouri to help put a stop to this. Really, first of all, we need to raise awareness. So what you said earlier on is tomorrow we're all going to be gathering with family and friends, and we need to have this conversation around the dinner table or while we're having dessert and alert people as to what's going on and the importance of what's going to happen so quickly here within the next week. What else can be done?
Well, there is good news, Lisa, and here's the good news. 36 senators have signed a letter saying that they will not support any treaties in the lame duck. And while that's heartening in some regards, in that it only takes 34 senators to stop a treaty, they didn't exactly pledge to oppose a treaty. They just said they wouldn't vote for cloture, which is a technical term. It takes 40 senators to stop debate on something. So we need a few more senators to sign on to this letter. One of Missouri's senators, Roy Blunt, has signed on to this letter. The other one, Senator McCaskill, has not signed on to this letter. So what I would urge you to do, again, as our listeners gather around the table tomorrow and celebrate and give thanks, talk to your friends and family. And give them this simple message. Call your U.S. senators and ask them to oppose the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities and to oppose the Convention on the Rights of the Child. There are better ways to protect children, to protect the disabled, than surrendering our freedom to the United Nations. The Capitol switchboard is 202-224-3121, and if you visit parentalrights.org or our other webpage, hslda.org, for the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, our listeners can find out much more about these treaties, how they can get involved, how they can share it on Facebook, Twitter, and find enough information to pass on to their friends and family.
Absolutely, and we'll put that information up at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org as well, so that you'll have an easy link to get to that information. Also, I wanted to ask you, we here in Missouri, in the Patriot Movement, with all the devastation of losing the election, the Patriot Movement is we're trying to regain our footing and gather steam for the next move forward in protecting the freedom of our country, and, you know, and Missourians and Americans across the country. How can we look at our state and the laws in Missouri to help maintain that sovereignty against these kinds of issues?
Well, you would know better than I would about the laws that are being worked on in Springfield to protect freedom in Missouri. And there are many states where conservative state legislators are working on this to say we're going to be a bulwark for freedom against an encroaching federal government. So you would know better than I would the specifics in your state. But what I would encourage our listeners to do is don't be discouraged. Our country is an incredibly blessed country, and whenever I think of Thanksgiving, I think of that Norman Rockwell painting of the whole family, the generations gathering together at the table and the turkey being brought out. And we've lost before, and we pick ourselves up and we keep fighting, because what we're fighting for is so much more important than one election or one candidate. We're fighting for our future generations, for our children and our children's children, that they would be able to live in a country that's free. So get involved on these issues. Call your senators. Oppose these treaties. See how you can get involved at the grassroots level in your county, in your state, to take back first your community, then your state, and then taking back our nation as well. Get involved in organizations like, Lisa, what you're doing with the Grassroots Conservative Radio out there in Missouri, and don't be discouraged. Don't stop fighting. If we have listeners who are saying, oh, we lost, it's over in our country, don't stop fighting for freedom. It's always actually easier to stop bills from happening than to pass other legislation. So I'm pretty optimistic, actually, that if we as conservatives, if we as patriots stand together, we're going to be able to stop these treaties and then stop a lot of the bad legislation that's being attempted to be moved, and then maybe come back winning in 2014 and beyond.
Oh, very good. Very good advice. Thank you, Mr. Will Estrada of parentalrights.org. Look for that information on MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. We will provide those links for you so that you can contact Senator Claire McCaskill. Obviously, you know, we have issues with Senator Claire McCaskill. That's no secret here. We need to put the pressure on and let her know that we're not interested in these UN treaties coming through, and your voice needs to be heard. Will Estrada of parentalrights.org, thank you for being with us, and have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Lisa, and same to you and all of our listeners.
Thank you. Please come back again and keep us updated on these issues.
Would love to.
Thanks.
While we're talking about parental rights and education, we took some time to talk with my very good friend, Dr. Brian Ray. It's so hard to find anyone who can talk straight on these issues and put them into true perspective from a historical standpoint any better than Dr. Ray. His intensive research and his common sense message really bring the culture of parenting and education into a reasonable sensibility. So please enjoy this interview with Dr. Brian Ray.
So we have with us, I'm so happy to have him here with us, my good friend, Dr. Brian Ray from the National Home Education Research Institute. As you know, I'm a homeschooling mom, and I know Dr. Ray through that organization. Dr. Ray is the nation's, probably the world's foremost authority on homeschool research. And if you go to National Home Education Research Institute, you'll see a lot of that information there, and he puts out great information throughout the year about homeschooling and family issues and parenting issues and how the government infringes upon that. And last week he put out an interesting article that just pushed my buttons. I was reading through this, and I actually went online and read the article today. and I was so angry, I think I need to go on blood pressure medicine after I read it, because the left is so vehement about wanting to, I mean, and if you stop and look at it, I mean, it's just in every aspect of our government about wanting to come in and take away your decision-making rights as a parent because they want to control your kids. And I'm a homeschooling mom, so I have a bias here. I mean, through that process of homeschooling, I really became very aware and I understand very clearly about how institutional schools can sometimes really be, oh gosh, I really hate to say this because it's kind of crazy sounded, but they're just institutions of indoctrination, and government schools can really just put a different mindset into your kids. And I'm so glad I homeschooled. I'm so glad I made that decision to homeschool my kids. But anyway, we have Dr. Ray here to explain that article that he sent out last week and to kind of talk about how that shapes and influences our culture. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Ray.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Lisa.
It's great to talk to you again.
What are we going to do about that that little presentation I gave? What did we call that? It was a little article. It was Data Less Academic.
Yeah. And, you know, and I went online and I actually read that. I read through that article today. And I really do need to go on blood pressure medicine. I mean, these people aren't even trying to mask their agenda anymore. I mean, they really do. They want to cut the ties between families, parents and children. They want to undermine your ability to practice your religion and pass those values on to your kids. I mean, there's so many aspects of it that you could approach it from. But you gave a nice little short synopsis of it in your email last week, and I kind of wanted to bring you on here to kind of talk about that and to give us an overview of how that works.
Well, one of the things that strikes me right away is that you mentioned, you kind of paused. And I'm not sure what to say. This almost sounds a little, you know, what'd you say, kooky or far-fetched or something, but it's not. And I think people have to understand this. When they listen to a talk show, they might say, oh, you know, the Lisa, she's kind of right-wing, she's a little over the edge. That's nowhere near the truth. The reality is the people we're talking about, some of these academics, and they're not a tiny minority. It's all the way from only the state should control what children are taught to, well, the state should control a lot of what they're taught. That's the whole spectrum right there. You know, so, and if people don't believe this, and I know it sounds like, well, yeah, I got to go read my little articles. It's fun. It is. It's free. Mm-hmm. But this lady, this Dr. Feynman, mm-hmm. She basically wants all private education abolished. Now, Americans might not think that exists today. It absolutely exists. They cannot stand the concept that a private association like a school, or a private association like a family, that old-fashioned thing called the family, where there were actually two people who biologically, whether you think it was all time, chance, and mutation, or God created it, whichever one, that old-fashioned concept of a family cannot really raise a child anymore. These people, it's not Lisa who's far out and over the edge. It's these people, these academics, these professors, and many of them become or influence policymakers. That's the reality of what's going on. It's incredible. Just interrupt me, because you got me excited here. I'm just going to start blabbing.
Well, let's back up a little bit. Let's talk. This paper that was published, and I think it was published in 2009. Am I correct
about
that?
Yes, 2009. Martha, Taking Children's Interests Seriously.
Yeah, by Martha Feynman. She is, let's see if I can get my my Wikipedia. She's a feminist attorney, kind of a... let's see. Let me get this up here. Okay, she is an internationally renowned. Robert W. Woodruff Professor of Law at Emory University School of Law, internationally renowned law and society scholar, leading authority in feminist legal theory and family law. Okay,
yeah,
family
yeah.
law and feminist legal theory. Okay, so now here, you lit my fuse. Here we go.
Yeah, stick those together.
Oh, I'm
telling
you.
What are you going to get? Why, this is what I wonder, Lisa. This is what I wonder. Why would a feminist think that the state has to raise children? Well, I don't know. What is the connection? I thought feminism was about empowering somehow women. And if the state is in control of a woman's child, how does that empower a woman?
Well,
it's
you know,
my mind.
And there's so much of that attitude out there. I think really, I mean, a woman is empowered if she is free to walk out of her house, walk away from her family, and go out and get a job and be a productive, money-making person who pays, you know, taxes. I think they consider that empowering. You know, and it is empowering. I mean, if you want to make that choice,
yeah,
that's your choice. But the reality is it needs to be a choice, you know, and the choice
exactly,
has been taken out of it.
That's what I'm wondering. That's what I'm wondering. If she's free to do that, she's also free to stay home and be just a homemaker, unquote.
Yeah,
or
exactly,
just a mom, unquote. She should be free to do both. So why would this woman suggest home education and private education be abolished so the state, that leaves the woman absolutely no choice over how to educate her children. And by the way, you mentioned, you know, again, you were a little bit hesitant to say that. Oh, you, I know what the word you used, the I word, indoctrination, the
mm-hmm.
I word. But this is what I believe all parents, all Americans, all Romanians, all Bulgarians, all Brazilians have to realize. Every form of education, whether public state-run schooling, whether private institutional schooling, or whether private home-based education, every single one of those forms is the teaching, training, and indoctrination of children. And indoctrination is not necessarily a dirty word. It means putting doctrine in, putting what you, the teacher, thinks is truth into the child. I'm sure this Martha Feynman has some ideas of what she thinks the truth is, and she wants the children to get it in state-run schools.
Basically, that's what I got. When I read this paper, it doesn't really read like a research paper. It reads like an editorial to me. Because
oh, absolutely. It's theoretical, ideological.
As you clearly pointed out in your article that you sent out last week, there's not a lot of research to back up her assertions in this paper. And what she's trying to assert from what I see here is that basically parents are really not competent in many, many ways to make these decisions for their kids, and that this should be left up to the children. And one of the questions that I had was that, you know, what research is there out there to say that the children, at what age are they competent to make these very important and life-changing decisions on their own? It's just, they need their parents to make those decisions for them.
Yeah, I agree with you. Let's talk about research for a minute. You said, and I might have said it this conservative way in the article, there's not much research to back up her claim. I'll tell you what, as far as I know, there is no research to back up her claim that the state needs to be involved, and when the state's involved in children's education or controls children's education, that the society at large has a better educated population, that children at large are better off. You know, I know of no research like that. First of all, I got to consider, we've had institutional state-run schooling for the majority of children now for just over 100 years. Now, some people might think that's a long time. Some people might think that's not very long, but it's not very long. Until 1900, institutional state-run schooling, as we know it today, was not the norm. It was about 1900 that it became, for the majority of the children, the majority of the day, you know, something like 9 months per year. But what evidence does she have, and this is a rhetorical question, what research evidence does she have that before 1900, people were less civil? Before
mm-hmm.
1900, people were kinder to each other. Before 1900, there was less crime. Before 1900, there was lower literacy. Before 1900, it was a worse place to live. Before 1900, people were more stupid, or whatever you want to call it. There's absolutely no evidence for that. Now, if you want to talk about blacks and slaves, okay, yes, but that's a different story. But as far as generally speaking, private associations, freedom to choose, she has no research evidence that the state becoming the compelling, coerced, educator for the majority of children made it a better nation or made children better off generally. She has no research evidence to back that up that I know of. She did not offer any.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing that she spoke of in this paper was that it was very important for there to be a balancing of the interests of the children. Or she drew a conclusion that if parents were the sole decision makers for children, they would too often insert their religious views, and it wouldn't be there would be no balance from what the state wanted them to have. So I guess that was the balancing of the interests. I'm not really sure what the state thinks that they need to bring into balance?
Yeah, let me deal with that in kind of a two parts. First of all, when people like her throw out the word religion, it's a bit of a red herring to the reader and to the public. And I want to make something that I think is extremely important and clear here. If we talk about religion just being simply, oh, certain people who believe in a God, or certain people who believe in this God of Christianity or this God of Islam, you know, if it's just sort of a theology thing, like a pure theology thing, then you can kind of put those people on the fringe and say, well, we got to make sure that nothing extreme happens so we don't have any parallel societies. But let's get a little bit broader than that, and people listening can look this up. Religion can be easily defined more like this: the values, beliefs, and worldview by which a person, a group, or society or system tries to live. So when you look at it that way, everybody, whether it's this Martha Feynman, whether it's the state schools, whether it's a private school, whether it's a homeschool, everybody has a religion by which they try to live, whether they know it or not. And it's clear that for a long, long time now, decades, the state-run schools of America, the public schools, have basically a religion. And some scholars, I can't quote all the names right now, but for example, Dr. James Hunt, James Carper, Thomas Hunt, others before them, they claim, and they make a very solid case, I think, that the public schools of today serve as the established church in America today. Mm-hmm. So that's my first point. Everybody's religious, and all of these schools are religious. So it's not really going to be religion that's controlled out of the child's life. It's just that a different religion would be put into his life if he goes to public school. Second part, what's the balance? And this, I think, this argument has an Achilles heel, or tendon, whatever you want to call it. She and some other scholars, and I know them and I read their stuff, say that we got to not just talk about parents' rights and the state's rights, we also have to think about the children's rights. And at first blush, that kind of sounds good. But now I'm going to try to make this really simple for myself. So let's say you have the state's rights, the parents' rights, and the children's rights regarding a child's education. If there's an argument about the children's rights, the way Dr. Feynman sees it, and other academics I'm thinking of, the state will decide what is the children's rights. So you really collapse this three-legged stool, supposedly, back to two legs, state and parent, because the state gets to decide what's the child's rights. So it's a ridiculous argument. It goes back to the state versus the parent deciding and having responsibility over a child's education, and the child, until he's not a minor anymore, really doesn't get to say anyway.
And if you put a contest between the state and the parent's not going to get it either. It's going to go down to the state.
Well, that's the point, and that's why it's so dangerous in what we allegedly have as a free country in these people's minds. It's very dangerous when all that's left is the state deciding 13 years, and some of them want more, of a growing citizen's teaching, training, indoctrination. How is that a free nation if the state is in charge of teaching, training, and indoctrinating something like 87% of them? There's something wrong in that equation.
Absolutely. And there's a growing philosophy that you're starting to see a lot more of. I mean, I see it a lot more because I do a little educational research. And we're also looking at, in Missouri, and most states actually across the country, I think almost all of them have already adopted Common Core standards from the federal government. So that state-run education is state-run across the board, Common Core standards from the federal government. We have it here in Missouri. It was adopted outside the purview of the legislature through the Department of Education here in Missouri. There is just this attitude from the federal government and in the states as well that there just needs to be mandated universal public education for everybody.
Yeah,
and
that's part. It's an incredible shift. Yeah, go ahead. Finish.
No, it's fine. And she speaks of it in her paper here. So go ahead.
Yeah. I hope people can grasp this. Up until about 10 years ago, the individual 50 states most of them did not want anything to do with these Common Core standard types of things. They said, wait a minute, you know, we've got 50 United States, we have 50 different education laws, we don't want some professor in California in cahoots with some bureaucrat in Washington controlling what happens in the education of children in Texas. But I don't want to be pessimistic. There's been a shift, definite shift in the attitudes of Americans, obviously, over the last 50 years or so or more.
Right.
And in the last 5 years, I don't know if it's apathy. I don't know if it's a sense on the part of Americans that they have no influence over public schools anymore, which might be true. But all of a sudden, whoosh, Common Core standards swept in. I think it's now the majority of states, is it not?
And I think it's at least 48 states the last time I looked at it.
Yeah, that's far more than the majority. So I think sometimes I'm too theoretical, Lisa, and I'm sitting here thinking, okay, let's say you've got the average mom and dad, middle-income America in Kansas, and let's say they say, well, I believe in the Constitution. I believe in the founding documents of America. You know, I believe in a good education for my child. I don't really like a lot of things I hear going on in the public schools, and yeah, that was pretty bizarre when they made my kids go in and learn at age 12 about prophylactics, you know, but I'm kind of busy, and really, the last time I went to a meeting with the school district, they didn't really care to hear from us, and it's a committee anyway. How in the world would I ever get on a committee that affects the curriculum, and why would I ever want to get involved in the bureaucracy that's involved at the state level, you know? For the typical parent, I'm guessing over 80% of them, I'll just make up a statistic, they have no sense at all that they have any influence over the state-run schools of America. Absolutely no sense of any ownership, any ability to change anything. And essentially the whole system runs on its own with professors, academics, policymakers, and bureaucrats. That's how it works today.
Yeah, people like this Ms. Feynman. Are in control with this kind of a mindset. I just want to read a paragraph that came out of this paper. It just made me crazy. I sent this to you and I started having typos in my email to you because I was so upset over what I was reading. Okay, so my comfort level with leaving decisions to parents is profoundly affected by the extent to which any decision is likely to have implications for the child in the future. Some parental choices will not have much long-term effect on the developmental well-being of an individual. Children are very resilient and can often recover from parental selfishness, short-sightedness, mistakes, bias, or ineptitude. Thus, a child can recover or never experience real a disadvantage from being deprived of piano lessons for the sake of a trip to Disneyland. Other choices, however, may not inspire confidence about the children's assumed resilience. Certain parental decisions can create handicaps and inhibit a child's entry into the secular and complex world in which he or she must live and function as an adult. I mean, that paragraph to me pretty much sums up the mindset of the people that are running institutional schooling across the country. They look at parents as an inept.
Yeah. The basic bottom line concept here is an elitist, holier-than-thou attitude of far too many, I'm not going to put a percent, but it's an awful lot of academics and professors that a plain old parent, just some high school graduate who just makes a lower middle income salary, has no certification in child training, no certification from the government in teaching, no certification from the government in proper nutrition, really is a dunce. And just basically have the baby, raise the baby till he's 4 or 5 years old, put him into school, and let us raise him and teach him and train him and indoctrinate him till he's 18 years old. That, I'm sorry to say, Lisa, that is the attitude, huge portion of state university academics today. That's, if you could get them to tell the honest truth, that's about where they'd be. And they won't talk about her comfort level. Who cares about this Professor Feynman's comfort level? She doesn't talk about, 10 years ago we had government-funded research that shows at least 10% of all children in public schools are sexually abused or sexually harassed by public school personnel. She doesn't tell us about the psychological abuse of the teachers. She doesn't tell us about the huge pressure by the peer group to get involved in premarital sex. huge pressure to get involved in drugs, huge preparation, you know, pressure to get involved in you know, alcohol. She doesn't tell us about the stories. If your readers can see these stories, I have time to read these stories because I work in an office for myself. I have time to read the internet. Just, what, 2 days ago, in a classroom, public school classroom, where if the child didn't make the goals of the group, the teacher allowed, I can't remember, the teacher or children, to write on the faces of these children who didn't pass with indelible markers. They go home in shame.
Oh, my God.
Indelible markers on their face. You see, Americans don't, they're almost oblivious to this. They don't know. That's just the tip of the iceberg. It's like you only hear about the really bad, bad, bad stories. The other 90% of the stories never make it into the news. Parents, I don't know why a parent would want to put their children under the authority of the state and the bureaucracy to do this. I don't understand it. If they could see the things I've seen and watched in person and in the news, I can't understand a dad wanting to put his child under that authority of the state. I don't understand it.
Well, you know, here in Missouri, our state legislature has been addressing issues of educational reform very, very hot and heavy for the last couple of years. And their version of educational reform is to advance charter schools and to eliminate boundaries across the within the state for people, for children to leave the cities, the inner city areas, which is what I think they're targeting, and to be able to cross those boundaries into the outlying counties to go to, quote, better schools.
Uh-huh.
Instead of addressing the underlying cultural issues that come from those places where they're not getting the, where their family foundation may not be as strong, which would support a better outcome in education. And I know that you, Dr. Ray, released a study a couple of years ago that compared homeschooled educated kids versus institutionally educated children, and I'd kind of like you to expand upon that a little bit.
Okay, yeah. This is what's incredible. I interact with people like this, Dr. Feynman, and I read their articles, and I write articles, and I publish, and we'll go to research conferences and talk together and so forth. And here's a simple concept. If it's true that in study after study after study after study now for 30 years, when it comes to academic achievement of home-educated children, that on average, they're outperforming those in public schools by 15 to 30 percentile points. If that's true, and that is what's happening in the study after study after study, if that's true, and if it's true that now 25 years of research finds basically every time the home-educated children are examined with measures of psychological, emotional, and social adjustment, they do as well or often better than those in public schools. If that's all true, and let's just say it's true that they just do a little tiny bit better. Okay, just a little tiny bit better. Why would these professors not be promoting home-based education to all parents? It's because they don't want the parents to be in charge of what's taught to these children in terms of political theory, political thinking, social thinking, family thinking, values, beliefs, and worldview. They want the children to be in the state schools so they can control those concepts. So here's the deal. You asked about the study. Yes, once again, I found, on average, home-educated children do quite a bit better academically, roughly 30 percentile points than those in public schools. Now, even if we could control all the variables like parent income level, parent education level, skin color, all those things, even if we could control all those factors statistically, I'm quite confident we would still find the home-educated doing better academically. In fact, a few studies lately have done just that. So the question still arises, why won't Dr. Feynman and the others who criticize home education, why will they not actively promote home-based education when these children are doing so well?
We just heard from William Estrada just, you know, a few minutes before, talking about the United Nations treaties coming through in the UNCRC, and that's, I mean, I see this kind of thing. I see the UNCRC written all over this paper.
Oh, yeah. She's Dr. Feynman and people like her are hand in hand, handing the love, whatever you want to call it, with those concepts that they'll say it's about children's rights and about protecting children. It's not at all. At the final analysis, it's about people like her and the state being in charge of the education and upbringing of children. I mean, this whole concept that, oh my goodness, if we have 1 million homeschool families in America, one of the parents or a few of the parents might educationally neglect the child. If that were really the case, what are they doing? I just saw a billboard the other day from some organization that said 28% of all American kids drop out of high school from the public schools. Why is there not all the energy and the theory going into that? What's the deal here? I mean, where's the evidence that the home-based education is a problem? And if it's such a problem, why does Dr. Feynman, well, I guess she did. Why doesn't she go after all the Catholic schools, all the Lutheran schools, all the pagan private schools? Why doesn't she go after them? She did. I mean, she's the ultimate. At least she's being honest. She wants to abolish them all.
Right. I mean, she said very clearly that she thinks that public education should be a mandate for everyone. And yeah. And while I'm a homeschooling advocate, I think homeschooling was wonderful for me and my family. It doesn't work for everybody, so there are alternatives. There are very good private alternatives for folks that want to send their child to an institutional school of some sort. But when we just went through an election where we had, you know, if in Mitt Romney's words, 47% of the electorate who is pretty much on the government dole, you know, who's been conditioned for generations to vote a certain way or to look at the government a certain way, you know, that didn't happen by accident, folks.
No, it's not an accident at all. And I think people got to think about this. You could, you know, sometimes, again, people will listen to people like you talking or me talking, and it's the average mom and dad with the kids in public school, and they say, oh, these guys are just kooks. All right, here's the challenge. Go into your local public high school, your local junior high school, randomly pick three from your area, and go in there and open up the social studies sections. Read a little bit about what they say about economics. Read about what they say about various hot-button issues. And, by the way, researchers have done this. And ask yourself, what exactly is the overall general perspective or worldview being taught to these children? And you're going to come out, unless you've found some amazing exception to the rule, you're going to find out that it's rather socialistic, it's rather statist, it's secular humanists, humans are their own gods, whatever you want to call it. It's anything but what the founding fathers promoted. It's anything but what you will find in a clear reading of the U.S. Constitution. It's very, very different. So if we've had 80 to 87% of children in these schools now for about 100 years, why would you expect anything different than sort of a victim mentality? The government, which actually means my neighbor, owes me, by force, must give me food, shelter, and clothing and education. Why would anybody expect anything different after well over 100 years of all the children, the vast majority of children being in those kinds of institutions for 12 or 13 years? It's a natural, logical conclusion that you would get what you get in terms of voting these days.
Yeah, the system has worked very well to achieve what it's been working to achieve for 100 years. Absolutely, the cultural...
And so if a parent is listening, if you're listening, parent, mom or dad, and you're thinking, you know, this is kind of hard because I say I believe in Constitution-based government, U.S. Constitution-based government. I say I believe in the Declaration of Independence. I say I believe in the Bible principles and truths, even though I might not exactly be a Christian, you know, I say I believe in all these things. You've got to ask yourself, then why are you handing your child over to be taught a very different worldview by almost every single public school system in America? Why are you doing that? Why are you doing that? And dads and moms, you're the ones who are responsible. You have a lot of choices. You've got private schools. Some of them are expensive, some are not very expensive. You've got home-based education, which is quite inexpensive. You've got the decision that you can make. You know, you want to live with two sort of nice cars, or are you willing to live with one sort of nice car, one beat-up car? Are you willing to live on two semi-nice vacations, or maybe one per year? But anyway, all of that has to do with what you want to allow professors, academics, and policymakers to indoctrinate your children with for 9 months per year, 5 days per week, 6 hours per day for 12 years of his life.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Brian Ray of the National Home Education Research Institute, we thank you so much for being with us and enlightening us on this very serious cultural issue through education and how this has affected our families and our children and the outcomes of our kids. Where can we go to get more information from you?
If you want a little research or kind of other information on the research on home education or just links to home education in general, you can go to nheri.org. That's N as in national, H-E-R-I.org. And I just want to repeat one more time in case anybody tries to take this out of context. I think every parent's got to remember this. Every professor's got to remember this. Whether children are in state-run public schools, private institutional schools, or home education, in all those situations, children are being taught, trained, and indoctrinated. So I don't want anybody to come out of this saying, Dr. Ray said they're indoctrinated in public schools and nowhere else. It's in all of them.
No, you have the opportunity to indoctrinate your child the way you want them indoctrinated.
Yeah, that's right. And then they can kick and scream for a few years, and then they can get themselves re-indoctrinated when they're 18 or 19.
When they go off to college, absolutely.
That's right. Okay. Thanks a lot, Lisa.
Thank you, Dr. Ray. We really appreciate it. We hope you'll come back and update us when you come across some more information. And, folks,
right,
I'm telling you, if you want the best information on home education or any kind of national education across the country, go to nheri.org. Dr. Ray has just got study after study. He's an independent researcher. He survives on donations and his research information there. So support National Home Education Research Institute. If you have an opportunity, go to the website, take a look at it. It's a great source of information on any kind of any kind of educational information that you might be looking for. Great studies there, and he's also done quite a bit of work through with HSLDA and helped them with promoting homeschooling as well. We appreciate him being with us and hope he comes back to see us soon. And have a great Thanksgiving too, Dr. Ray.
I want to thank you for joining me tonight on this Wednesday evening, the day after New Year's Day. I hope that you've enjoyed the program. We'll be back again live next week with another full program for you. And we have a lot of good things in store for 2013. Please also join Dave Court on Monday evenings with the Hour of Truth at 7 p.m. And in 2013, we're going to bring you some new programming on Tuesday nights. Cindy McGee of Show Me Patriots will be on at Tuesday nights at 7. And Cynthia Davis. We all know Cynthia Davis. She ran for lieutenant governor and served 8 years in the Missouri legislature. Will join us at 8 o'clock on Tuesday evenings. I'll be here, as I said, every Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. And on Thursday evenings, Kevin Harnard, Mr. Hillbilly Logic, will be here on Thursdays at 7 to help you make sense of all of the craziness going on here in the state of Missouri with his unique brand of Hillbilly Logic. Missouri Grassroots Coalition would love to have your support and your membership. It costs nothing to be a member of our organization. Please go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and join. We're going to be monitoring very closely the local and state government, and we would love to be a coalition of thousands of people strong to be able to go to our elected leaders and say, this is exactly the way we want you to govern and rule and how you want us to represent, how we want you to represent us. So go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, hit the Join tab and give us your information so that we can keep you informed and engaged on all the issues. And look for us also on Facebook and Twitter. And until then, we will see you here again next week at 7 o'clock on the Culture Vigilante Hour.
Missouri Grassroots Radio is brought to you by the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a cooperative of independent Missouri groups whose aim is to restore constitutional government. Visit us at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter. You can contact us anytime at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. God bless and keep you till next time we meet.